Dallas.
I would say a few kind words, if I may.
Please.
Okay, welcome, good evening, to this seminar given by Professor Charlie Beckett on political communications in the age of austerity, which has now grown a subtitle, How St. George Farage Took on the Party Dragons, nice and topical. This is one of a series of these seminars that we've been holding under the banner of the British government at the LSE. I'm Tony Travers, by the way, as I said at the beginning. And what will happen is Charlie will speak for perhaps 25 minutes, half an hour, and we'll open it up for questions and discussion. Charlie.
Great. Thanks very much, Tony. I'm very pleased to be here, partly because it's good to sort of make contact with the Department of Government again. It's also good for me because this year I've been doubling up as head of department as well as running POLIS. And as Simon knows, there's no doubling up on head of department. It's rather all-consuming, which means that what follows is notes on research, I suppose. It's an attempt to... Well, I started writing about, you know, been thinking about political communications in the age of austerity for the last few years, and was trying to think of a way of tying it down a bit. And then along came Nigel Farage and UKIP, and it was both a wonderful opportunity to examine a number of themes that I'm interested in. It was also, as I started scribbling away, realised that it was something of a challenge to some of the blithe assumptions that I've been making over the last few years in my work, which is particularly looking at the idea of media change or news media change and what I call network journalism, in other words, how journalism changes in the digital age, and particularly political journalism and the implications for democracy engagement and so on. So, yeah, what follows is an attempt to sort of pull some themes together. And obviously, very much looking forward to any feedback that might help me to shape this into something more coherent. In the past, if I was, I should apologise. I'm going to be reading from these notes because I've only just sort of written this thing. I'm trying to remember what I was thinking. But in the not so distant past, if I had been talking about political communication trends, and I'd be talking about things like Facebook and Barack Obama, or Twitter and Nick Clegg. But, as it says there, today I want to at least start off talking about Nigel Farage and the George and Dragon pub. There are thousands of media scholars, particularly, who are out there analysing Occupy Wall Street and the impact of social media. But instead of always studying the formerly avant-garde, the marginal and the aberrant, I think that perhaps we ought really to be looking at how the populist disruptors have actually stormed the mainstream with often quite conventional tactics. And the latter have actually been, frankly, much more successful politically. And they're also interesting because they are indicative of a wider series of trends around political communications. As I said, my work assumes that we realise we're now in a digital environment of networked information flows, yet despite or because of this, the analogue and the authentic are much more important than ever. And this is about austerity, the particular condition we're in. So I think the very big question for tonight is what I'm going to describe. Is this what happens to political communications when your economy is collapsing and the democratic system is seen as both out of touch and ineffective for delivering things like material security and political accountability? My answer to that question is yes, but only if the system and circumstances allow it. In other words, it's a political choice, a policy choice, or a communications choice. So the interesting outcome is not whether Nigel Farage will become Prime Minister, but what impact UKIP is going to have on UK politics, and from my much more media-centric point of view, what impact he and other people, perhaps like him, like Boris Johnson, are having on political communications. Now, how does it happen? In the case of UKIP, we know that the main issues that provoke this kind of populist movement are material. It's things like immigration, economic crisis, unemployment, real things, household inflation and so on. Things like crime, things like the power of the European Union. We also know who the people are who support UKIP. They're generally older, male, working and lower middle class, and previously Tory voting. But they are much more than a niche. Beyond these issue-related concerns, the potential for this kind of populist political insurgency is enhanced, I think, by familiar political structural trends that you're all familiar with: the decline of the parties, the dilution of tribalism, and increased scepticism about authority, and the growth of more diverse identity and special interest politics. And as I think we'll see, the criticism of the incoherence of the support for people like Nigel Farage completely misses the point that this set of values and so on is a coalition of imagined as well as very real anxieties. Now, I'd argue it should be taken, this kind of populist surge should be taken seriously for at least three good reasons. Firstly, it's indicative that something's wrong with the system. So many people feel hostility to the political structure and the public sphere that fails to address their concerns, let alone actually deal with them. Secondly, this kind of trend has the potential to shift policy outcomes. The other parties, as we've seen already, feel obliged to react to the popularity of UKIP, and the overall tenor of the debate, the nature of the debate, is being reframed to the exclusion of often some other under-recognised demographics, like pro-Europeans. And the third reason is it has the potential to exacerbate potentially damaging structural trends in the UK towards a kind of democratic malfunctioning. It's quite possible that the other parties will actually retreat from the policy spheres that UKIP addresses, and will also fail to learn the lessons of citizen engagement. In the short term, the electoral math probably favours a conservative response, certainly in the short term, from the other three main party leaders. But I think that would be a mistake. So that's the political context. But what's the significance for political communications? First, some assumptions. I think we have to recognise that the conventional model of British liberal democracy and political communications is in the process of a structural reorientation, to put it mildly. The traditional idea that the news media, the place where I used to work, the idea of the news media as a fourth estate that helped the flow of information from the governed to government, and that it created a space of deliberation that somehow informed policy making in a linear, predictable way, I think has changed. I think those relationships at best are now in a very unstable and, at best, a networked relationship. And if you like, there's sort of three reasons for that. What's happened to political communications? There's the internet. It's a catalyst through social media and network digital communications. And that's created more flows of information and deliberation that are much less subject to control. This doesn't mean that populist movements are always born out of digital communication. The five-star movement in Italy and Beppe Grillo, they were certainly facilitated originally by his blog, and their use of social media was very useful in mobilisation. But the key to his success was physical demonstrations, and also great success at conventional elections. So what gave Five Star impact on public consciousness wasn't particularly its networked nature, but that it had a charismatic leader who personified an alternative to the way politics is done in Italy. And in a sense, Nigel is an English version of Grillo, though, as we see, there's significant differences, not the least of it that Farage and UKIP are largely non-digital. Secondly, for Farage and Griot to be successful, they have to look and sound different. And this is partly about what they talk about, of course, but it's also down to not being like the others. And the professionalisation of political public relations and its thoroughgoing domination of policy generation, of executive operation, and of electoral campaigning has created within the mainstream parties a completely corporately staffed corporate culture. This goes back many decades, but I would say it's now reached its kind of generational apogee with a public, with a prime minister who was from a public relations background. And the recent coverage of Cameron's so-called chumocracy, I think, reinforces it. And it reinforces it because it's true. The other factor is what I've called the personalisation of political discourse, which is happening both by the politicians and the public itself. And this is partly about things like presidential politics, the idea of prioritising emotional engagement, you know, the constant use of symbolism, but also by the public themselves, who very much stress the perceived values, not the policies or class allegiances of the people or parties they vote for. Both mass and social media place very high value on visual cues, key phrases, personality and appearance. Yet, I would argue that mainstream politicians are actually not very good at this kind of politics. And it's because, in a strange way, they don't accept the argument that the medium is the message. Farage absolutely does. But it's simply what you see is what you get. And I'd like to put it in a wider context of how people are now bombarded with the corporatisation of political ideology that is then put into a personal framework. I want to show you a couple of videos. I come from a television background, so I always retreat into moving images. I'll put this one up somewhere. It's going to let me do it.
Life is your life. Don't let it be clubbed into dead submission beyond the watch. There are ways out. There is light somewhere. It may not be much light, but it beats the darkness. Beyond the watch, where gods will offer you chances. Know them. Take them. You can't beat death, but you can beat death in life sometimes. The more often you learn to do it, the more like it will be. Your life is your life. Know it while you have it. You are marvelous. The gods wait to delight in you.
This is what we do in the media department. We watch videos all day. It's actually a splendid one, isn't it? Yeah, obviously this is, that's clearly a film that seeks to take, various visual tropes of youthful counterculture and appropriate them for clothing marketing. And if you take note of the reviews, the 4 million people. Now I'm going to show you another video. A version of that video which makes an explicit critique, to put it mildly.
Your life is your life. Don't let it be clubbed into the bank submission beyond the watch. There are ways out. There is light somewhere. It may not be much light, but it beats the darkness. Beyond the watch, the gods will offer you chances. Know them. Take them. You can't beat death, but you can beat death in life sometimes. likely to learn to do it, the more light there will be. Your life is your life. Know it while you have it. You are marvelous. The gods wait to delight in you.
And yes, I do want to close the time. And the point about this one is,
if you look at the number of views, it's 30,000.
But I would still, you know, I'm not suggesting that that somehow that's the majority view. That the what's interesting, I think, about that is that that Jeans video, even in its commercial format, is far more political than any party political broadcast or NGO advertisement that you're likely to see. Although, of course, simultaneously it seeks to, you know, depoliticise the very, you know, imagery and language that it deploys. So it's not surprising that, therefore, that, you know, the research that we've done shows that the public are now universally sceptical of political or ethical marketing, because it's now become like the commercial marketing that has, in its turn, assimilated the personal and political communications space. So the public are now, in what my colleague Lily Kuliraki calls, the public are now ironic spectators, and that they're now effectively operating in what she calls a post-humanitarian communications environment. And I think the professionalisation of political PR has got to such a thoroughgoing point that the public is now unable to distinguish between commercial and civic communications. And this is not just about politicians lying. Though, of course, you know, when Nick Clegg found out belatedly that taking a principled position that you don't actually believe in isn't a good thing, and then his so-called apology, what was interesting, his so-called apology actually only worked when it was satirised. It was only when the humour of the, you know, the famous musical version of it made it more human than the original, very calculated communication, that it actually had any kind of sympathetic impact on the public. So it's not just about lying, it's also not simply about being out of touch. As Steve Richards, a political journalist, pointed out a couple of days ago, this isn't true. Politicians are, in fact, neurotically, he said, obsessed with keeping constantly in touch through focus groups and opinion polls. Instead, I'd argue that the problem is better understood as about the distance and detachment of politicians from the discourse itself. Mrs. Thatcher, for example, rest in peace, Mrs. Thatcher was a great example of a politician who could be and was willingly manipulated in presidential terms. You know, the voice was lowered, the hair was softened, the phrasing was tightened up by superb scriptwriters and so on. But in the end, it was her ability to project her personality of ideological self-confidence and her political aggression on policy issues and ideological conflicts that ended up winning people over. Now, one response to this growing sense of discourse distance has been the personalisation of political discourse, both by, as I said, the politicians and the public. The public want politicians who represent their feelings and instincts about life and ideology. They don't want someone who represents a policy manifesto, note to Ed Miliband. And again, historic trends such as education, feminism, individualism, have fostered this trend towards the personalisation of politics, and both modern mass media and, more latterly, the development of social media have accelerated that trend too. And as we know, politicians in the UK who have been most successful when they respond to this, Thatcher and Blair, and less successful when they can't, such as Major and Brown. Yet the paradox of contemporary political communication is that the professionalisation of this personalisation is counterproductive, because in an age of increasing scepticism, the one value that the voters want, which is authenticity, is rendered completely undeliverable by professional political class that seek to secure their power with risk-averse, non-interactive communication. And this is a message that even conservatives understand. This is something from today where a stalwart of the Shires, I think he's actually in Cameron's constituency, you know, points this out in very brutal language. This is very much my thesis about Farage. But, you know, in response to this, kind of stating the obvious in a way, but the answer is, well, can Osborne and Cameron, in this case, change? Or is the reality that they are so detached that they can't argue the opposite? I mean, that's why when Cameron and Clark, I think it was, made those, you know, they made irretrievable mistakes when they called UKIP clowns and fruitcakes. It was ironic because, of course, for once, they were actually saying what they really thought about those people. And it was irretrievable because it was actually a rare moment of authenticity on their part. And that's why Nigel works. His policies are incoherent, but he has the personal ability to embody people's personal anxieties on immigration, Europe, bankers, Etonians, corruption, etc. And I think, as has been pointed out, that's particularly impressive when you think he's a privately educated city trader who apparently is married to a German. And he's also, as I said, totally analogue. He succeeds by being on TV and radio a lot, as well as in newspapers, of course. And he's probably more successful because, although, you know, he is an MEP, his party, of course, is firmly outside the mainstream. And, of course, that popularity might change as he and his party sidle up to power. And, of course, as they also come under scrutiny from competitors and from the press. And he doesn't seem to have a strategy for converting the protest vote into sustainable support. So I'm not arguing that somehow, you know, Farage is going to form the next government. But, however, protest is becoming a permanent part of the British electoral makeup. UKIP does represent such a sizable chunk of unrepresented public opinion that he, or what he represents, remains a real challenge to the other parties and how they communicate. So the answer, next question is, well, how do you reconnect politics? Anybody's been to see this?
Yeah.
You should have had a departmental away day to this. This is this house at the National. You can't see it now anyway, because I think it's sold out. But it's great fun. And you know, this fantastic play, obviously, tells us about a kind of pre-Thatcherite age when it was taken for granted. And the characters, it's fascinating how the characters absolutely take it for granted that they speak on behalf of their tribe of supporters. And the disconnect that's followed from that, still, I would argue, hasn't really been factored into the makeup of the politicians, the parties, and their communication systems. And I think this is mainly because the parties really don't want to. The Conservatives are very anxious not to get dragged further down a kind of Eurosceptical road, while the Labour and Lib Dems are obviously very uncomfortable at the kind of anti-immigration agenda. None of them have an economic answer that doesn't involve more pain and the perception that they're serving the interest of either a rich elite or, on the other hand, scroungers. And so electorally it makes much more sense in the short term for those mainstream parties to hope that UKIP blows over and that its voters trot back to the mainstream, especially when they're faced, those voters are faced with a ballot box choice, you know, of choosing a government rather than their local council. But I think if that's what happens, I think that ignores the lessons of political communications that Nigel Farage teaches. I was mentioning earlier to you, Simon. Our research, this was a piece, it was actually a lecture that Stella Creasy gave 3 or 4 years ago when she was a freshly minted MP rather than a jaded shadow minister.
3 or 4 years ago? She was like 17, wasn't she?
That's right. Still finishing her LSE, is it doctorate?
PhD.
Yeah. And as a report, which, I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but she was very strong on using social media to get elected, and then in various local campaigns, and particularly in her campaign against payday loan sharks, as she would put them, informal banking, I think other people call it. And she was very strong at using these networks, and in this she talks about the potential of it and so on, but she also talks about the limitations. She shows that yes, the networks are very much useful catalysts for specific campaigns, and overall they do provide new, albeit very unrepresentative, channels for feedback and for some limited debate. However, social media isn't enough. Mainstream media is absolutely still the primary driver of political content on social media, frankly, and as well as being, of course, the dominant provider of political information and influence to the voters. So the parties can use social media to realign their conversations with the public, but in the end, they have to address their failure to take on board what they're hearing and their reluctance to engage with the debates and discourse that might be emerging around or be revealed by factors like social media. So in other words, they have to change who they are as well as how they communicate. And trying to sort of wrap this up, and in that sense, it's a question of responding to wider shifts in the media environment. This was a paper I wrote which looked at, it was based on the case study of Kony 2012, and it looked at the sort of ideological purpose and effects of, in this case, online campaigning by NGOs. But I think the same contradictions that are revealed by organisations, in this case organisations who are effectively looking to use these channels of communication for marketing and fundraising, and I think that's very much analogous with political parties who see these channels of communications as a way of marketing and, well, partly fundraising, but mainly of course vote raising. And I think the contradiction between that of organisations that are so in effect so desperate to achieve those goals that they neglect the value systems of those communications networks, which are much more about at least an appearance of reciprocity and interactivity and dialogue. And so, as I say, it's a question of whether they are really prepared to respond to those wider shifts in the media environment and the changing public attitude to ideological communications. People expect transparency, and they prefer, clearly they prefer, open, shareable social content. Mainstream media might still be the dominant force. It certainly allowed UKIP and Farage to emerge, but it's within that wider communications and indeed the social context that makes political communications much more complex and uncertain than before. At a time when you're seeing the political parties assuming that they can have even more control and more predictability around their communication than before. So, unless you have your values embodied in your communications, as Nigel Farage has so successfully achieved, and unless you can claim a genuine rather than some fake or assumed authenticity, then you will struggle to convince. Thank you.
Right, thank you, Charlie. Sit down.
Yes.
I'll open this up in this meeting, but when you finish there, I just written myself a note to say, in your first video, I suspect most people in the room watching the video will have watched it knowing what they were watching. We're all aware of the tricks of the business, and I think most people watch TV ads know all of this. So you kind of know what's going on. When you then overlay it with the anti-capitalist messages, I suspect most people have already picked that up, and yet they can even enjoy it while still picking up the both the original message without being told, and the later message, you know, when you've got a new added-on sort of political message. So, and it begs the question of, which you touched on at the very end yourself, which is, given how good PR and advertising people are, because the first ad, the ad you showed, is just a testament to the brilliance of the advertising industry, really. So can that same industry fake authenticity? I mean, given they've created a world where you can't tell the difference, arguably, almost between the real and the unreal, are they possible now reverse engineering that in order to fake authenticity? Or does it just have to be perceived as authentic by people completely overwhelmed by decades of the sort of invented PR and advertising world? So Farage and Boris Johnson being the other one you touched on at the beginning.
I think one of the sort of two groups of people who would be upset by what I'm saying, one of them are advertising people in a sense, or at least ethical or political advertising people, and the other ones are sort of social media, because in a way I could have given that as a wonderful case study of the satirical one being a wonderful case study of how people can push back ideologically. But I think you're right, two fronts why that doesn't work. Firstly, because no one watched the tiresomely early special.
Yeah.
But also because, as you said, people are already processing that.
Yeah. They know that the pictures of protests when you're selling jeans or soft drinks are you're being manipulated, and you can enjoy it. That's quite a nice feeling.
And then the key question is, what was the purpose of that communication?
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right in that. The jeans advert, I'm sure, worked brilliantly, just by the views, because they were selling jeans. So I'm not making judgments on how Levi's or I've been wrong to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the challenge then, as you said, where people are so saturated by that kind of beautifully, that you could easily imagine, I'm not quite sure who it would be, the Socialist Workers' Party running the same kind of imagery. I mean, they probably would have done the sexy bits. We go back to Red Witch, they deploy rock bands or something, so you can kind of imagine somebody doing that as a tirade against the policies of austerity, the voiceover from Owen Jones. But it wouldn't have worked. The reason why I don't think it would have worked, because it would have been sort of indistinguishable, only literally, but its effect, its ideological effect, from Gene's commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I think that kind of rhetoric and that kind of imagery and so on has been, what's the word, neutered, perhaps, or assimilated. And that's why, and the interesting bit is, well, what do you do in those circumstances if you are trying to have an impact, convert people? And I mean, my work is more with NGOs than it is with political parties, but on the political side, I think Farage is the evidence that you should dump your advertising agency, at least next priority, and not stress the media, but stress the message. And with Farage, it may be a very confused one, but everyone knows exactly what they think they do, what he represents. Now, that's true, he represents a nuclear rage against the system. Well, that's exactly how a sizable group of people feel. So in that sense, it's authentic. You couldn't make up a natural Farage and stick him onto your political party.
Okay, well, that's just a going. Simon? Martin?
Yeah, I accept the thesis you're making, which is that we're in a moment now where the public is very sceptical of sort of engineered political images by politicians, and that's why they love Boris Johnson. I can see two potential reasons why that might be the case. One is good old-fashioned populism. Populism has come about because we've got economic downturn, a very cosy political elite. you know, collapse of manufacturing and just social groups in society that's just been ignored by mainstream politics for a long time. And the populist moment in British politics is just absolutely here now. We've had populist moments in other democracies all over the world. And when you get a populist moment, anything a mainstream politician says, the public just completely ignores. So it could be that. Or it could be that the public is just generally more sophisticated about media and communications than it used to be, and hence we now know what the tricks of the trade are of these politicians, and we're cynical of them. We consume our political messages in a much more curious way than we ever used to, so we don't just buy the party line from a particular newspaper, TV stations. So these might be reinforcing each other, but yeah. I would actually think it might be more of the former than the latter, given that most of the people that are actually engaged by Farage are not actually that physically savvy or sophisticated as many we like to think they are, and so they're not.
I don't think they are at all. So I think the evidence, the demographic evidence shows that they're not.
So it might be that the reason why, what I'm getting, I'm not sure about is what explains why we're now in a situation where.
Well, I don't think it's just a populist moment. I agree with you that I think, this is quite a long moment, the austerity moment. It's much more profound than a recession. And it certainly plays into what we know are longer term trends of disengagement and so on. And
decline support for women's
in terms of communication, I would argue the way I mentioned things like education, women's empowerment and so on, which means that those trends are going the other way. So in a sense, it doesn't really matter. So I think that the populist moment is, what I think is remarkable is the incompetence of the response of politicians, mainstream politicians. That's what I find. And I think this isn't one of those flip things, the kind of, they don't get it things. If only they were on Twitter, they would be fine. The disaster you see is, Miliband tweeting today, respect to Sir Alex Ferguson, he's one of our greatest ever managers. Everyone just a hailstorm back at him saying he's not dead. It's just obviously somebody in his team had written this, a formal response, and it was disastrous because he wasn't responding. I don't know if he likes it or not, cracking my heart. So that's what's quite, that's a cheap job. But more generically, I think there's something going on which is, as I said, partly about this corporatization, professionalization, which they combine with this personalization. They think they're personalized politics by being super smooth, airbrushed, careful, glib, taking the jacket off, all that stuff. So they think they've addressed this concern, but I don't think they have. It's a bit of a cheap shot. Not disaster, but and I don't know. I'm generally not sure whether this is because of my sort of democracy theory. This is somehow there because they're all now seeped in the culture. They literally have no reference point outside their machines, or whether it's more of a fundamental problem about how you conduct politics. Shrinking bases and all that stuff, but how do you conduct politics when that old structure, from a communication point of view, of the fourth estate and so on, which at least delivered control over the public sphere for those politicians, meant they had that space. It broke, not entirely broken down, it's almost exaggerated, but it's a diminishing space. And so it's a kind of like there's this, they're retreating to drier land, higher land, rather than thinking about why the water's rising. I think there's the amount of extraordinary talented people working on digital communications still are utterly powerless compared to, in terms of impact, the pound spent, whatever, to someone like Farage. I think that's quite remarkable.
Okay, 2, 3.
Three comments, not necessarily consistent. One is, I remember, so now I go to literature in my age, remember when the first German protest party managed to get into state parliament with the record, the Republikaner in Berlin, it's a small state, where I was lucky enough, but not lucky enough, to watch their spot, their TV spot, so traditional advertising, 1980s stuff. There was a black and white thing with you know, showing immigrants and all that, and was daily. So, I mean, I can see that populist parties go for second world elections with shocking images and then win. They never win in primary, sort of first world elections,
right.
I would suspect. So, in a sense, is that really A, a new moment, and B, is that really, you know, it is an open election after all, perhaps. The other point I wanted to make is these, and then if one sort of goes back, where sort of else? So would you then say, if one looks elsewhere at the sort of rise of anti-system parties, sort of Austria and so on, that didn't really happen in circumstances with the polished PR people. So I wondered whether, associations seem to be making, like, sort of they get more and more polished, and therefore we get sort of the, you know, the Nirvana movement of now we all play unplugged from 1980s music gets more and more bombastic. I mean, is that really sort of the case if you look at other sort of European countries?
Yeah.
And can I just make one final point? And I wondered also, I mean, last week sort of James Stoker was here to talk about his sort of studies on what he calls Boris and stealth democracy, and sort of he looks at the population profile there, and there were sort of two things there. One is that it is, I mean, you didn't want to say it, but it came out, a UKIP voter is the last one who reads a newspaper. So in a sense, you're looking here, you know, so the UKIP voter is exactly the one who is, hey, dying, is male in the 1960s, so should, rather get it wrong, you might say, if I'm a big party, why do I give a damn about a dying person who still reads a newspaper? But at the same time, and that's sort of, I think, another kind of this issue is it's being inconsistent. So to some extent, they say we hate the system and we're good of it. At the same time, they seem to be also showing that kind of we want to engage. So that people are not just the anti-system people. So I wonder too about whether, so one can just make some kind of case that everyone is sort of disconnecting, but rather people are extremely inconsistent and populist parties sort of play on one side as the values, but when you get to primary, first of all, elections, you get sort of the other kind of. So I wonder.
These people are not sophisticated enough, so it's not worth bothering.
Yeah. And then the kind of final point I wanted to make is in 90s, the populist parties in Europe, the small ones, they didn't have membership base. So they, you could say, they were the first one to use proper political communication by going direct to voters. You know, I mean, the German fascist guy, he sold his newspapers, sort of outside newspaper agents and so on, and got his word out of that. So in a sense, even there, you get basically sort of a political communication before Twitter or sort of targeted messages by animal newspapers.
Yeah. Now, I think your point about the dreaded inconsistency of real people is true. I think that's looking at it from a communications perspective rather than, I'm not just a scientist, but I think it's that there's more inconsistency amongst the public, more instability, less set of views and so on, and less firm allegiances. And I think in a sense that there is something going on at moments where, you know, I have moments of pity for politicians because they can't win in the sense that it's partly fostered by media, the influence of the social trends. The kind of skepticism is such a default. No one will ever say, yes, I approve of a politician. I wouldn't say it publicly, because that would be to admit that they were somehow, enthralled to them, or they were stupid, and etc. So there's a kind of culture of pervasive skepticism. And I think that breeds a kind of instability. Well, you're pointing out the content and all these interesting, certainly cultures like Germany, which has had a much more professionalised political class for much longer, and they're much bigger political class in a sense, they're more politicians. It's very difficult to do the cultural comparisons. But I think you're right, the fact that they're professional does not in itself breed insurgents. You know, it's only when this is sort of science point about it's about austerity. that may lead to this kind of spectacular successes. And the other good example from Germany, of course, is the Pirate Party, you know, the who...
But now gone.
Exactly, that's what we're about to make that point. That, you know, they arise and they finally made the Today Programme because they got 10% in the polls, and I think by the end of the Today Programme they've gone down to 2%. In that sense, I'm sort of making a jibe where I started the talk, a jibe against, when we think about insurgency, as opposed to populism, say, you know, traditionally, not traditionally, but over the recent period, especially because of the interest in social media, we have looked at things like Occupy Wall Street. I mean, every other day, somebody comes, there's a doctor application, I want to look at, you know, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy London Stock Exchange. They never, you know, I'd be interested to get any of Nigel Farage and UKIP. And the interesting thing is that I would argue that the Occupy movement has been a complete disaster. It's had no impact in a short term or in a structural sense or even a cultural sense. It's not had an impact as a model. For the amount of attention it got and even the amount of activism that seems to be involved in it, it's gone absolutely nowhere. And so there may be something about the lesson, which is that you have to be much more like the populists. One of the things I think is an interesting sidebar question to the populist question is why there isn't left-wing populist movement, certainly not in this country. In Greece, briefly, you could argue that
the Germans
possible.
I think.
Yeah, but exactly. Although they rapidly became sort of So I agree with you. I certainly wasn't making the case that Farage is some sort of insurgency that's going to change itself to change him. I think it's much more. It represents completely. Neglected set of, or obviously set of political attitudes, but also I think it also represents a sense of how people want to be communicated to. Again, if it's that easy, if you just have to hold a pint and smoke outside a pub and say various rude things about Europe, it's interesting is it because that kind of demotic language, or that kind of straightforwardness is impossible if you are a responsible party that wants a sophisticated program? Or is there some kind of lessons to be learned? And I think there are lessons.
I mean, just to pick up that idea, I get your point, I rather agree about the Occupy movement, but actually, briefly, the Occupy movement did capture public imagination, and rather less briefly, it affected the language of politicians across the spectrum about how they spoke about some issues. Tax avoidance, you could argue, is an issue where they have had a long-term impact. Equally and oppositely, but much more so, UKIP may never get a seat in Parliament, but it's hard to argue they're not influencing the Conservative and Labour parties' policies as we speak on some scale. Mm. So, surely what these, I agree with you about the sort of snow and sunshine element of the Occupy movement, but it did briefly change the tone of debate. And what UKIP appears to do, probably over a much longer period, I would hazard a guess, is influence the major parties in a way that they feel powerless. That is, that you can see they are powerless in the grip of UKIP's view of the world on some issues.
Yeah, and I think on the UKIP side, I think there's a real problem, which is that, as I say, I genuinely think I agree with the chap from Oxfordshire. He's urging Cameron to be like Farage, but I think it's almost impossible.
I mean, Keith is a sensible mainstream conservative, who's a really good leader of Oxfordshire County Council.
Yeah, he's not a barbecue with high general. But I think he's completely identified the problem, but I just seriously question whether they were able to respond. And this is partly a big bit sort of materially deterministic, but if you do hire a bunch of Oldisonians or sharp-suited bullies, whatever the Labour Party is made up of, then I'm afraid they are so constitutionally of that makeup that they're just never going to be able to respond. On the Occupy thing, what's happened is interesting is, yeah, I agree with you, there was a moment largely driven by not public interest in Occupy. The 99% didn't give a hoot, but the media, mainstream media, was fascinated. And the bit I'm into with social media, we were equally fascinated because they were doing all these things about, you know, the human megaphone and having their own blogs and all that stuff. And yet, what's interesting, that they look at, strangely, they were completely lacking in politics. They had no sense of how this might translate into the kind of impact that you're talking about. And it may be that because, and here's a sort of media in itself, I thought, that they were so into the performative aspects of what they were doing, that they didn't, they had no real sense of a political objective. And, you know, they didn't have a structural, they didn't have a theory of change.
Can I just ask, would you put George Galloway also in the same box as Nigel Farage?
I'd love to put him in the same box. That would be brilliant. I'd love to put them in the same studio, that'd be great.
Yeah. See, we must have an LSE public event. George Galloway meets Nigel Farage.
Yes, yeah,
that's a very good idea.
Sorry,
we have to go to the movie. One, two, three. What are you making?
Yes, thank you very much. Is there a paradox or contradiction between a sort of desire for authenticity and getting it and it not being more cracked up to be? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about political party conferences that they're sort of stage managed and people long for that sort of authenticity. I think that's a sort of example. But what if they were allowed to sort of roam free in the long grass and lots of crazy people came out? And what do you think, how would that affect sort of perception of politicians, authenticity, inauthenticity? A second one, what is the relationship in terms of communications between a sort of prevailing culture, like you get into the tabloids that, you know, it's often about benefit scroungers and immigrants and this sort of thing, and that creates a culture, that creates a sort of problem that UKIP also says is a problem, doesn't necessarily propose answers and such, but, and that sort of creates that culture. And are you actually overrepresented? That, you know, they didn't get 50% of the vote, they didn't form governments, they haven't taken councils left, right and centre. Is it the fact that they're a youth phenomenon? Does that mean that they are overrepresented, or is there something deeper and more significant than that?
Yeah, on the first one, you just described Labour Party conferences of the 70s. again, there's what we might say is there's a sort of false dichotomy there. You're quite right. There's something more amusing than hearing advertising executives talking about we must find an authentic message or an authentic image. The party conferences are a neat example of this, actually, you know, PhD, that, of course, they've now become mainly, you know, stage sets. And any real political discourse in the public conferences obviously happens in bars. You know, it doesn't happen. I mean, even the fringes are increasingly controlled and predictable and so on. You know. Now, what's the answer to that? The answer isn't to say, yeah, come on, Derek Hatton, come back in and let's have real decision making on the conference floor, necessarily, unless that's what you really want, unless you really do want a democratic Labour Party. I think, again, the conference study was fascinating is in a world where I'm sure all of you have been to quite interesting conferences, interesting seminars, and interesting events. The conferences just aren't one of them. You know, it's extraordinary, just in a sort of formal, practical sense. They completely miss all the lessons that people have done with video conferencing, unconferencing. You know, to be fair to a certain Labour Party, they tried to move to these sort of policy-making conferences, which at least have a sort of trying to do something. They're trying to do work, even if it doesn't necessarily mean they control the party, they're not shifting power. So I think they're a wonderful example. I mean, I think the conference is a wonderful example of a complete sort of neolithic political communications format. So it's not necessarily whether you know, they change their nature. I think they're almost redundant. Your other point was...
It's more about the authenticity than about conferences.
Right, well, sorry, but what is an authentic... Well, that's what my point would be. What do you mean by an authentic party conference? Is it one where you throw out...
You want heckling, do you?
Yeah.
Heckling.
How allowed.
No, it's more about the... What would happen... What would people think of the UKIP if you put the UKIP party conference on the TV? With all its authenticity, will there be people then watch it and go, these guys are a bunch of nutters?
But I mean, when there were such party conferences, some politicians made hay and successfully used them, most notably Harold Wilson, who was very, very good at dealing with noisy hecklers, and used that authority and his quick wit to establish himself as a populist and a man of the people, when actually, you know, he was a clever man and well distant from people, puffing with the pipe and all that. It was all carefully contrived. He smoked cigars, actually, Harold Wilson. So, you know, it's not new, any of this stuff, is it?
No, but I think that was managing different sorts of... Harold was you know, shouting down hecklers in Blackpool. It was because the people in that hall were making policy to a degree, you know, certainly circumscribing the state government or party in ways that wouldn't be when David Cameron takes off his jacket and strolls around the stage without an auto cue, which is, you know, an admirable thing to do. But it's not necessarily the same thing as authenticity. Now, obviously, authenticity is entirely in the eye of the beholder, but, you know, people find Nigel Farage authentic. Now, as Simon says, you don't necessarily want him to run the country. So I think that it's right that I think it's, and by its very nature, of course, politics is about having to, you know, compromise and convince people of things that they don't want to be convinced of and so on. So in that sense, authenticity doesn't mean kind of libertarian free will, but it does mean that you are able to, embody more and believe in what you say. So again, it's not just being a decent geezer. Your point about the media is sort of, is that your point, where sort of the media is kind of raising these issues which people weren't with. I know what you're saying, and I know many of my colleagues would argue that everyone in this country would be raving socialists if it only Murdoch did not exist. I don't believe that for one second. Partly because what I've just seen over the time is that those opinions of Euroscepticism, that sense of people being so disturbed by immigration, and more importantly, recent immigration, talking about rather than being racist as such, those issues were not on the agenda despite of the political parties, despite if it was that simple. If it was driven by the Daily Star or the Sun, then it would have been, and it wasn't. I think of this country in particular, where organisations like the BBC would just never, you never hear a vox pop with a bunch of ordinary people being, you know, being reasonably racist. It just seemed, just wouldn't represent that. It would always be seen as something of a voice that wouldn't be heard. I think of other countries like, I did journalistic work before I came here, in the Netherlands. When Pinkertan, the famous gay libertarian anti-immigration politician, and it's extraordinary going around the Netherlands with people saying, you know, no one wants to talk about this, and it was like a sort of relief that they were at least able to talk about the thing. So I think, if anything, I think that media has neglected these concerns, mainly because they're incoherent. What do you say? You know, once you've said, somebody says something which is often completely non-factually based. With immigration, it's actually very factually based. There has been a lot of immigration. People have been dislocated. People have felt culturally challenged. And yet those views will never treat in a clear way. Mainly because it doesn't always fit into the sort of news narratives and journalistic narratives, especially of the kind of mainstream press, which is very much parallel to mainstream parties, and find that incredibly difficult to handle.
Is this directly on that point, or are there other ways?
Well, I'm waiting.
Okay,
all right.
Okay, come
on. Okay, well, first of all, I agree with approximately 90% of what you said, though on a past political point as a lapsed Liberal Democrat, I've got to point out our conferences do make decisions that then the
completely
ignore you. Well, they make the coalition a slightly more exciting place to live through. Moving on, a fairly good-natured challenge. I would argue that Farage, as the sort of inheritor of the mile-wide, inch-deep protest vote that would inevitably have previously gone to the Liberal Democrats, although for obvious reasons not anymore, isn't necessarily the most impactful example of this sort of transition. I would say that Scottish politics in particular, the SNP's use of, the blogosphere, the alternative media channels, where you have political blogs claiming readerships, multiples of the major Scottish dailies, and equally stories routinely being broken by those blogs and by bloggers in certain cases. That sort of critical mass of dialogue is primarily on cyberspace. It could potentially end up in independent Scotland because, as the bloggers themselves point out, the news media in Scotland is overwhelmingly pro-union, they actually created a space for themselves precisely for this reason. Would Scotland have been a better example?
Possibly, never been there. Except for Holland, no. As I'm sure Greg is weak. I think the nationalism element somewhat sort of distorts the argument in the sense that that is, when we think about nationalism, it's a very coherent set of policies and objectives. It's very well grounded in Scottish political culture in that sense. It was insurgent in the sense that Sam, even whilst in power, managed to pretend that he's fighting against the powers that be. What is also about Scotland, perhaps is a side issue, but is the decline of mainstream media post devolution. I don't know if that's because I wonder if it's been partly because of, in that scale, of a discourse here and a community basically Edinburgh and perhaps Marlborough, that really lends itself to the sort of the social media and that's not replicated in London, where the Guido Fawkes has had extraordinary impact, fantastically successful platform, yet he's almost any one, and the other discourse has been online discourse and politics has been much more, professional, so that's policy models and labour lists and so on.
Tim,
with the Conservative Home. Again, that was very successful playing to that party, and of course, having a wider impact beyond that. But I wonder if, in terms of actually, outperforming mainstream media, Scotland is a particular exception just because of the scale of the size, but also because it was such a it's such a defined debate there. So in that sense, I could argue that it's the kind of issues like immigration, immigration I think is the best example. It's such a problematic issue for all the parties to deal with, and yet it's obviously a major, major concern. It won't necessarily work for government on that, but it's certainly a huge ideological values issue that people raise. And it's a very disabling one, so it's impossible to address parties. As I said, it's about imagination, anxieties as well as real life. So I don't think that kind of plays in the same way as Scotland. I think nationalism is more
fewer. And there are many fewer, you know, I mean, without straying into uncharted and yet as yet unmeasured territory. Immigration is a very different thing in Scotland. There's simply many fewer immigrants, and indeed, English people, that's true. But I mean, in the rest of England, it looks very likely as if the UKIP vote will be smallest where the numbers of immigrants are largest. So if you're looking for a, and I said elsewhere, if you're looking for a way of predicting where UKIP votes were, you'd probably look at people who voted against the AB referendum or something as a proxy, you know. And so Scotland is different in lots of ways, as I'm sort of agreeing with you.
I'm interested in the pathology of the established politician, by which I mean Labour, Lib Dem, and the Tories. They don't, I think, they become defensive technocrats, really, all of them. And I think that in some ways they regard the media in general, the new media, old media, as an enemy. It's trying all the time to put them on the spot, and all the time they appear, this inauthenticity appears because they don't want to be pushed to say anything. And I think if you were looking for examples of authentic politicians, you have already raised two, Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage. But there are one or two, and they might be worth studying in this context, in the old parties, and why they're authentic. Why is Shirley Bloom's authentic? Why is she someone, for example, just an example, who, or Chris Mullin, who doesn't bleat about the 24/7 media constantly trying to exploit us, or unfair stories on social media? I mean, there is something about this defensiveness and the technocratic worry that if you say something today, you may be forced to do something tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, my version of this was writing with Gordon Brown, when Brown first came in, and I confess personally I'm not, you know, particularly sympathetic to him, but I was interested about whether this person could do what I was going to call ugly politics. Can you be ugly? I don't mean that to be offensive, but because, you know, they're ugly in not just the appearance sense, but this, you know, he's
hard and nasty.
Yeah, I told you he's charming in private, you know. So can you be rough edged, rough hewn, you know, roughly spoken, etc., and you call spades, you know. Now not, you don't have to go to you don't have to go to this really Boris Johnson, who I think is, you know, he is authentic, but in such a sort of, you can't all be Boris Johnson. But I was sort of theorising, well, can you, or could you be someone who does try and answer questions, who is prepared to say, I don't know, or this is going to be difficult, etc. Unfortunately, of course, Gordon is the opposite. You know, he was only really emerged later, but what an extraordinary control freak he was, and how incredibly oversensitive he was to any kind of criticism, never mind for the media. And I think in that sense it was a sort of logical outcome. He was like the bastard child of Alistair Campbell and Tony Blair in that sense. He didn't have Campbell's sense of communications for a purpose, and he didn't have Blair's flair, frankly, you know, for the rhetorical bypass. So I think there is something, and it's partly about the character of the person, like Alan Johnson, that's a good example. And the point about Alan, the postman, the former postman, whatever, you know, it is partly, I'm afraid, about what I call diversity, and I don't just mean that.
On the other hand, people might argue he came a proper because of that.
Yeah, but I think there's a system which is so.
I don't know what a percentage point is or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
But, but it's partly because it is so risk averse, you know, it's so. And it's a self defeating thing that the more you. Are frightened of ever this, and I think it mistakes what the public are not sitting there as do some lobby journalists saying, ah, oh, that's interesting, he used a slightly different adjective about public spending this week than he did in his speech in 1986. Nick Clegg, that's different. You know, when you say, actually, do you know what, we didn't believe that in the first place, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That's, and he tried to do it. Although I'd say dealt with it disastrously, because he was incapable of really saying something. He didn't mean something. So yeah, I think it's partly about personality, it's about diversity, it's about having different people in politics and particularly parties. But then it is also about, if you like, not a style thing, it's more than that, but it's about you can't face down the media all the time, but you can disarm them. And one of the things about social media is it's supposed to help you encourage feelings. And I thought that the Edmund Abend interview, I thought we had David Mark Carney, was one of the most extraordinary things I've heard in years. Here was somebody who's the leader of a political party, wants to be Prime Minister, and yet on a very basic economic point, being very politely pressed by Martha Khan, didn't have an answer, and at one point said, what was it? You don't understand, Martha. And that was what an authentic moment. That was the policy monk who had come up with a brilliant line, beautifully judged, with his advisors, before he went on the world at one, who when actually asked a straight question, couldn't come up, he literally could not articulate a straight answer, or even an approximate answer. And I thought that was an extraordinary moment.
I
don't
aren't we in a situation in British politics where there's such high volatility, and we're not quite attached to parties, and wouldn't we be having the same conversation if we were just around the time of the last election about Nick Clegg? Suddenly came from nowhere, seems authentic, tells it like it is, seems very straight, breath of fresh air, different to the mainstream. So isn't this just the nature of British politics right now? Not whether this is Farage. That's one point. The other point is about the mainstream media, and we have a political establishment and political elite, which is very, very London-centric. It's almost like you've got, you know, one party representing Islington and one Notting Hill and one Putney.
That's right.
And we've got a political media which is very London-centric.
Yeah.
And all these guys all know each other and you know, the rest of it. And we've never had such huge socioeconomic and regional divisions that reinforce each other in British politics ever, as far as I can count. And so, isn't this, it was kind of bound to happen at some point, and aren't we seeing that a breakup? And what's so surprising is actually UKIP is not just a right-wing phenomenon. UKIP is actually, you know, it's Labour voters that have been ignored by Labour for so long, and it's Tory voters and Shires who feel like they don't like the fact we've got gay marriage was another issue that came up in UKIP. But, you know, they can't stand the fact that Notting Hill set is so socially cosmopolitan. So part of it is just this
issue. Which I would add, and is an English nationalism.
I think that's actually true, and that was my point about it's who you are. And you're absolutely right that, you know, and it seems to sort of due effect here, that the political class has become literally more metropolitan London, and certainly the media has as well, that the regional television is in decline. If you look at news rooms, Guardian, I think it used to have, not that one, but it had an office with 12 people in it in Manchester. They now have one person who has to cover virtually all of Britain, North and what? I'm not joking.
She wrote very tired.
He's a client, yeah. And they've got this new woman who's even got a bigger brief than Martin. And I think that's absolutely true. I think that speaking as born and bred Londoners, middle benches, I just stunned at the increasing lack of diversity. And when I say diversity, I don't mean race and gender like stuff. I mean, from the media point of view, editorial diversity. It is quite extraordinary, as well as combined with the delusion effect of resource cuts and so on. What's interesting is my beloved social media, which I has fastened democracy, but in London.
Right.
So
there is much more transparency in discourse, diversity of sources, exchange, and communication between these people. You would never see communicate before. No, I can talk to MP on Twitter and blah blah blah. But it's all still in London. It's had no, in fact, I've got no evidence of this, but I suspect it's actually reinforced, the public sphere has become fatter, faster moving, and more intense, and much more interested in London. I think that has excluded, right, as you say, the similar thing coming up in the Netherlands, where books and the media, everything is in Amsterdam, and no one goes out to those stretches of bungalows in West Holland and so on where people really live. And it's a trend that's going to continue.
I'm just not a point speaking to that. There does seem to be, and this is more anecdotal.
The devolution's made.
Anecdotally, there does seem to be the rise of the localist bloggers, very centred around a particular area, not just in London, but Manchester, Birmingham, Bristol, Plymouth. And they seem to be popping up almost at the ward level. If an area is readily identifiable as a unit, there will be a X central or a X town block, and that does seem to be quite an interesting political space at the moment, because you have everything from childcare arrangements to the quality of schools to actually local political campaigners directly engaging, and I'm not sure if that is worthy of further study, because it seems to be quite a powerful tool for reconnecting people to the political process, providing it doesn't just become an endless series of NIMBY forwards.
A presentation on this a couple weeks ago, and now you're hyper local. I think one of the, it's too early to judge to start with, as the local media has been denuded, and I'm talking outside of London, we have yet to see digital media supplant. And that's partly because it works. Because a local newspaper, for example, is quite a specific geographical terrain. When you start to think about so-called communities, they often don't even have a specific geographical. But what I mean is communities of interest. For example, class or whatever. If I think of how I define myself, it can be by, obviously my class, and I work in town, I support football team in East London, I'm from South London, live in North London, my sister's from West London, I've got family in Germany, I've got family in South America, etc., etc. So I've got weird interests. So how does a local media represent me? If it's just telling me what's on in my local cinema, that's not really getting my attention. So for example, where I do live, there's something called the Kentish Town, which is identified a demographic of sort of young hipster restaurant going, mildly liberal people. But it is not the place of Camden New Journal. Camden New Journal still has that. I think that obviously has interesting implications for the local media business model. But more importantly, it has interesting ramifications for what you're talking about, which is democracy, activism, engagement. And I think, again, the model that will emerge around that will be communities of interest. It won't be that some local media, so it's, things like you said, local councillors blogging and then intersecting by operating across wider platforms from Twitter. But I'm not, I don't see it really delivering in a big way, partly because there are actually institutional forces at work to counter it. So local councils, for example, spend a fortune on, their literary fortune, are spending more than newspaper budgets on their corporate handout.
Although People's has actually very recently
tried to, that's right. But what it really is then to hand that budget over to, not local bloggers, but whatever media literacy initiatives,
1.5, whatever, so actually build capacity so that people do it for themselves. Plus, stop the restrictive regulations on reporting councils for social media, etc., etc. You know, that could be a real shift.
Right, we've got 4 minutes to go. So if anybody hasn't said anything would like to now, please feel free. You have to, if you'd like to. Otherwise, I'm sure those who've said things already would want to say more before I will. Well, let me ask you then. Boris Johnson.
Coming in 2 weeks.
Really? Coming in 2 weeks, yes. Having watched Boris Johnson close hand over some time now, what strikes me about him is that he's unusual, possibly unique among politicians, in that his mistakes are taken as evidence of authenticity. Very, very unusual. As if when he falls in Deptford Creek, for most politicians that would be seen as a metaphor for their failure, but in his case it's seen as evidence that he's a normal, good guy. Now, you know, I mean, no one observe it, but can we explain it?
Well, I think you can explain it part by the fact that he's mayor of London, he's not part of his foreign secretary, and that it's an adornment. I think it's partly explained by his Boris. As I said, you can't all be floppy haired on its own ears, etc. He has that privileged position partly because he is not like the others, and that's it, he's not Farage.
His policies. You could put a bus ticket between his policies and David Cameron's, except that he may well be slightly to the left of David on the other issues. And yet, so it's nothing to do with his policies.
It's not his presentation. You know, the same way that, you know, politicians are not. When did you last see a politician smoke? You know, we know that Nick smokes. So he doesn't want to. He didn't want to talk over there, it was amazing. He didn't want to talk about it. What idea? First thing you should have said is, I'm in trouble doing that. You know, not blah blah blah, which we'll talk about. It's quite a match to me in my cigarette. So I think you will always benefit from being not the others. But I think the lesson of it is that the public are much more forgiving about certain presentation bloopers. As long as you, in his case, he has both the enthusiasm and, genuine political sense. He has a genuine political sense of why he's doing this stuff. He's better than I do, but I get the sense that underneath that there's quite a serious politician who's motivated by trying to have things happen in a way that, he believes in. I think that's the definition of a politician. And he was much more convincing about that, I think, paradox, because he's somebody who doesn't mind any photograph hanging upside down on the wire and so on.
And I think it's an advantage as well.
Exactly. You know, so I accept that he is exceptional in his personality and his position, but I think it's sort of going back to the two parallels.
That he's completely elite, so elite like suggestive, who doesn't mention the job. So in a sense, he's authentic, or he's allowed to be authentic, because he's not threatening, and he's part of the social
Boris and Farage are both applicants too.
Exactly, so
what I would say to that is two words, Ken Wilson.
Say, Labour establishment,
no, Greece. Come on.
No, I mean, so basically, he's not Boris and
Farage. As in...
it's a bit like Harry Redknapp. I mean, he just sings, kind of sells stories to the journalists that basically they're not going to kill him off. They're seen as a good guy. I mean, sort of basically.
It's not because he's elite. He's forgiven.
But he's forgiven by the elite, by the journalists too, because they give him snippets. So basically, I give you stuff. You treat me as sort of a benevolent clown. And that is my recipe.
No, I think it's that.
Not if you
I think it's that. I think it's just that. Yes, it's partly that he's entertaining and he's a great story. But I don't think it's that simple. You know, I think there are enough people, enough people in the Tory press who would love to do Boris in, actually. You know, he has his enemies, supporters. I think what he writes is that what he does, and what that kind of character does, it's not because it's elite and they sympathise with him. Quite the opposite. I think that he doesn't play the game. If they say, aha, you score, so just like fucking you. How awful are they? How fucking awful? You know, so he won't play the game. And so you can't then hold them to account on that.
And that's Galloway's trick as well. Galloway won't play the game big time.
Yeah, and so did Ken Livingstone, who, if he said to him, you know, my God, you were hanging out with the IRA, he'd say, yeah, that's right, I am. And the most common phrase you hear from the public about Maxwell's attitude is, I don't always agree with him, but at least he speaks his mind. You know, and people will then at least give you some leeway and credibility in a way that they won't give to, for example, me, even though it's
right. Okay, prediction to the end there. Thank you, Charlie. Great evening. Thanks very much.
Great question.